From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made during an interrogation. Police are talking to a suspect in a case of a violent crime. They've been talking for several hours. It is late at night. The suspect is exhausted, scared, and finally, after the investigators have pushed, the suspect confesses. Okay, it's me. I did it. Confessions are powerful, and according to the director of the Northwestern Prison Education Program, confessions tend to swamp all other evidence in a case. Jennifer Lackey says that when a confession happens, that's it. The interest in other suspects or evidence wraps up at that point. Lackey is in Rochester to offer her perspective as part of the Humanity Center public lecture series. She says what seems like a breakthrough moment in investigation can turn into a miscarriage of justice. Lackey's presentation is titled Extracted Evidence, False Confessions, and Testimonial Injustice. Now, you might wonder, why would anyone confess to a crime they did not commit? And especially, why would anyone confess to a violent crime they did not commit? If it seems impossible to you, the evidence suggests it has happened with some frequency. According to the Innocence Project, in the past 30 years, 99 people in the United States have been exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence after they told police they committed the crime in question, when they didn't. Lackey came to this subject after meeting someone incarcerated after making a confession, but quickly recanting it. That confession carried much more weight in the justice system than the many other denials. And today she's talking about the issue and how she believes our system should change in many ways. Our guest this hour is Jennifer Lackey, the Wayne and Elizabeth Jones Professor of Philosophy at Northwestern University and the director and founder of the Northwestern Prison Education Program. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Joan Shelley Rubin, the Dexter Perkins Professor of History and the Annie and Mark Gabrielian Director of the Humanity Center at the University of Rochester. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
A brief hello to our news director, Randy Gorbin, intervening for just a moment. Hello.
And hello to you, Evan. Another fascinating show coming up. You know, we've done a lot of social justice issues, especially involving prisons here in WXXI News in recent days. In fact, next Monday, WXXI's Brett Dahlberg will be looking at the cases of women who have been convicted but not yet sentenced, still in jail, awaiting to see what happens with their situation. And that'll be coming up on Monday morning. But this hour, another important issue involving, as you say, false confessions. And to do this kind of programming, again, it takes people and it takes your support as well. We do have our 1 week issue this week where we're trying to get people to please support us. If you listen, if you enjoy Connections every day, as I know thousands of people do, you can call right now at 585-454-6300. 585-454-6300. Whatever you can give, do it on a regular basis, $5 a month, $10 a month, so do it in one shot. But it is something that is needed to keep this kind of programming coming your way here in the greater Rochester area. Or you can call the toll-free number at 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Or a safe, secure donation online at wxxinews.org or weos.org. And we thank you, of course, for your support, Evan.
All right, Randy, thank you very much. That presentation from Jennifer Lackey is tonight at 5 p.m. in the Hawkins Carlson's room at Rush Reese Library. And Joan, there's a theme to the presentations this year at the Humanity Center. Tell us about that.
That's right, Evan. Every year the center has a theme, and this year we picked expertise and evidence because we as a society today are very concerned with what is true. How do we know what is true? Who are the experts we should believe? What is an expert? And so this seemed to be a subject that was perfect for us to invite Jennifer Lackey, a philosopher, because philosophers for centuries have been preoccupied with how do we know what we know?
All right, so that's 5 p.m. tonight.
Yes, and I do want to stress that there is free parking in the library lot, and Rush Rees is that big building with the tower you can see from everywhere, so we hope that the public will join us this afternoon.
All right, well, Jennifer, I want to start with how you came to the subject of false confessions, and I want to let our listeners know as well, we're going to cover a lot of ground this hour because Jennifer not only teaches at Northwestern, but has taught philosophy and taught classes in prison settings and has a lot to say about your experiences there. From what I've read, it was teaching philosophy in prison. You encountered someone who had kind of talked about a false confession. What's the story?
So I was teaching a lecture on testimonial injustice, which is this phenomenon whereby someone's testimony does not get the credibility that it deserves because of some pre-existing prejudice or social bias that people have against the speaker. And I had a student turn in a paper where there was a lengthy story told in the third person about being taken by five white police officers into an interrogation room when he was 15 years old. Even though his father had taken him to the police station and had accompanied him, he was separated from his father. And after hours and hours and hours of interrogation, confessed to a crime that he didn't commit. He immediately walked out of the interrogation room, recanted when he saw his father, and is in his 30s now and is serving an 85-year sentence. And when he completed that essay by saying, "This 15-year-old boy was me." And I was immediately taken by the connection between the phenomenon of testimonial injustice and the way that it functions in our criminal justice system, particularly through false confessions, after meeting the student.
Did you believe that person?
Absolutely. I mean, I ended up learning through a lot of other sources that there's absolutely no physical evidence connecting him to the crime, that he was a particularly, primed candidate for a false confession. 15 years old, a lengthy interrogation, isolated from any support. There were just a lot of other, there were eyewitnesses that saw it was a woman who had been carjacked, an 80, something year old woman who had been carjacked in the parking lot of a Walgreens. And eyewitnesses had seen someone that they described as being in their 30s who had taken the car. There was lots of other evidence that pointed in another direction.
I don't have a police officer or an investigator in the room today, but I want to at least try to channel where I think they may go with this. They may say, look, when you are working on a case like this, you've got to deal with the evidence that you have. And when you have someone who tells you that I did this, of course that's a powerful moment. Of course that puts us in a direction of saying we can move toward closure here in some sense. So I want to explore that in a couple of ways. One of the points that you make, and I think this is probably really important here, is that you feel that when there is testimony, it can often be sort of underweighted unless it's a confession in which it's immediately given total supremacy. Yes?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that we need to recognize is that false confessions happen, that they're actually quite easy to get. I think that people have this conception, particularly with respect to something like murder, I would never do it. And yet the psychological literature shows that it's actually not that difficult to get us to falsely confess to something we didn't do. And so I think that the combination of saying, yes, there are false confessions, yes, they happen, they're not that difficult to get, should lead interrogators to recognize that confession evidence is one piece of evidence. It is not, a swamping piece of evidence such that once we get it, the rest of the investigation is essentially closed.
But your contention is it does currently swamp investigations.
Absolutely. I mean, the evidence shows that, case after case, even exonerating DNA evidence is often diminished relative to a confession. And so you have lots of people currently incarcerated right now for a false confession where there is exonerating DNA evidence, and the, state continues to push for the conviction to stand.
And I think it would be interesting to have prosecutors as well. I mean, there's a lot of layers to this about why the system is sort of the way it is. And as you see it, the flaws in the system. Are prosecutors too invested in getting a conviction if they get that moment of confession?
I think that that's one of the factors. I mean, I certainly think that, I would be reluctant to generalize about, what is operative in all prosecutors. I mean, I certainly think that for some of them, it is getting the conviction. I think for many people, there is this psychological, factor that you think you would never do it yourself. You think that if someone confesses to murder, this has to be legitimate. So I think that there are also just very innocent explanations for why the confession is weighed so heavily.
All right, our guest is Jennifer Lackey, who is presenting Extracted Evidence, False Confessions and Testimonial Injustice, part of the Humanity Center at the University of Rochester's public lecture series. Her presentation is today at 5 p.m. at Rush Reese Library. And the phone's already ringing. I see that if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In the case of a false confession, we mentioned at the outset here that there's something called the Innocence Project, and you might have heard them on this program in the past. They work on cases which they believe are cases of injustice. Sometimes it takes years to come to conclusions. From what you have observed, Jennifer, when you have someone who says in one moment confessing to a crime and then recanting it, does a false confession usually, and I don't know if there's a trend or a generalization you can make here, does it usually involve one moment, usually a stressed moment, and then recanting?
Absolutely.
Or does a false confession sometimes happen over days, weeks, and then years later someone says, I didn't do it? It's usually one moment, one interrogation?
I mean, you definitely see both, but there are lots and lots of...
Yeah, that's okay. Just grab that mic and put it right in front of you. There you go.
So you definitely see both kinds of cases, but there are plenty of cases in which the recantation happens almost immediately, mm-hmm. happens almost immediately after the person leaves the interrogation room. Once they are reunited with a support system, once they are out of the environment in which, you know, they were under pressure, sometimes under threat, under, you know, experiencing fear. So there are lots of cases where the recantation begins the minute the person leaves the interrogation room and continues for decades afterwards. And yet that one instance of testimony, that one confession, swamps decades of recantation testimony. And that's part of the problem, I think.
Okay, so if you had a prosecutor or an investigator say, okay, we hear you, but Jennifer, if you have someone who did commit a violent crime and spends most of their life denying it, but you have that moment where they break down and tell you they did it, shouldn't that moment outweigh the denials?
Well, I think that one of the recommendations I have is that the confession evidence be viewed as one piece of evidence. I'm not suggesting that confession evidence ought to be discarded. I'm suggesting that the confession evidence ought to be weighed with all of the other relevant evidence. So some of the cases that I talk about are cases where the state has to come up with an absurd theory to explain the totality of evidence. So for instance, there's a well-known case in Illinois of Juan Rivera, where he was convicted of raping and murdering an 11-year-old girl. DNA evidence, you know, eliminated him as a suspect. The semen found in the 11-year-old child was not him. So the state said, well, she must have had a consensual sexual relationship with some unknown man. He must have ejaculated. Juan Rivera did, in fact, come, rape her, and kill her, and he just failed to ejaculate. That is an outrageous theory that the state had to come up with to explain the totality of evidence. And the driving force of that theory is he confessed. So he has to have played this role in the crime, despite the fact that the, you know, all of this other relevant evidence points to someone else.
Let me grab our first phone call. This is Bruce in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Bruce.
First, I don't feel that anybody should be interrogated without counsel. I think that should be illegal. There should be no reason that anybody shouldn't have, and again, if they ask for counsel, you're supposed to give it to them. But in my son was accused of making threats against the West Irondequoit School District. They got the police department to take him in for questioning. I'm doing air quotes here. They said, please come to the car. They took him to the police department. Eventually he said, am I under arrest? They said, no. He said, then I'm free to leave. They said, no, we have more questions. He goes, I'd like a lawyer. Never got it. I'd like my phone call. Never got it. And finally, after hours and hours and hours of saying, no, that ain't me, they finally decided to put a mental health arrest on him. Now, we did a FOIL request for all the information in regards to his being taken in that night, and the interrogation tape for that was not given to us. So even if you know your rights, they don't necessarily avail you of it. There should be no reason that anybody's in an interrogation room without some sort of counsel.
What do you think, Jennifer?
I totally agree, and I think this is especially the case for juveniles. So in Illinois, there has been a big push for never allowing a juvenile, especially, to ever be interrogated without either a guardian or counsel present.
Yeah, Bruce, good luck to you and your family. Thanks for the phone call on that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I want to touch on a point that Jennifer Lackey was making earlier that, again, may stop our listeners and at least make you wonder. And it's the idea that a false confession is it's not even that hard to get sometimes. Mm-hmm. So let me read a comment that just came from a retired police officer, who says, it's interesting that eyewitness testimony and confessions are given so much weight, and yet they're the least reliable evidence. She is absolutely correct. A good cop can get most people to confess, confess to most things. It's even possible to convince people they did things they did not do. Oh, I'm listening. I'm listening here. But when you make the assertion, it's not that hard to get people to confess. Most of our listeners are wherever they are right now, are saying, you could never get me to confess to something I didn't do. No way. So how do we do this? How does it happen?
So there are different kinds of factors that contribute to false confessions, what are sometimes called situational factors and dispositional factors. I'm going to focus on the situational ones. So the situational ones usually involve things like the length of the interrogation, hours and hours. I mean, it's recommended that we do not interrogate for longer than 4-hour periods of time. Most false confessions, you know, kind of far exceed that. I think the mean is...
They happen after the 4 hours?
Oh, I think the average is something like 16 hours.
16.
So the length of the interrogation, being isolated, separated from, you know, support system, sleep deprivation, all of these things are, you know, kind of shown to contribute to false confessions. But the one that I want to focus on that I think is the most psychologically compelling is the presentation of false evidence, which is legal in the United States. So I can come up to you and say, look, we've got your fingerprints. You were there. We have your DNA there. You need to explain this. And so, you know, the comment that came in that said any police officer can get someone to eat. Sometimes we can even get you to believe it yourself. You see this actually when you watch tapes of false confessions. Someone will say, we have your DNA. And they'll say, I guess I must have been there. I don't know. You have people who are, you know, kind of oftentimes this is after a violent crime, the murder of your parents. And we're telling you, we have your blood there. And so then they will say things like, I guess there must be a good me and a bad me. And maybe the bad me did this. And I just have no memory of this even happening. It's not that difficult when we present you with what you take to be compelling evidence that you were there.
Even if it's a lie.
Given that it's a lie, and that you're in a situation where you actually don't think that we would do this to you.
Okay. So what do you propose about that particular part of interrogations? Should that change? Should investigators not be allowed to present false evidence in an effort to interrogate?
Oh, I absolutely do not think that we should be able to present false evidence during an interrogation. Absolutely.
What do police say about that? What do prosecutors say about that?
So what they say, the legitimacy of the presentation of false evidence, they say is, well, if you didn't do it, then you know that it's false evidence. So you shouldn't find it compelling at all. That's the argument. The presentation of false evidence is supposed to be such that if you're really innocent, you're going to say, of course you don't have my DNA evidence there. Of course you don't have my fingerprints. That's just not how human psychology works, particularly when you are in a situation where you're isolated from support, you're exhausted. In most cases, you just experienced a tragedy.
Wow. Okay, and again, logically, I think listeners are hearing that going, okay, I think that probably police and prosecutors are right there, that if Jennifer Lackey came to me and said, you know, Evan, why did you drive to Buffalo last night? I say, I was in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Well, here's a picture of your car. And I go, wow, I guess I drove to Buffalo. I mean, I think our listeners may be hearing that going, no way. I think I would probably say, you doctored this. That's bogus.
There was a recent study, quite recent, that presented doctored video evidence to the suspects that showed them doing the, you know, the action that they were accused of. It wasn't like murder, but it was an action that they were accused of participating in. 100% of the subjects signed the false confession. 100% when they were presented with the doctored video evidence.
And so you're saying we have to end this practice. That cannot be legal anymore.
Absolutely.
What do you see in terms of momentum to change that? Is there any momentum?
Not that I know of. I mean, I think that, you know, there are, I think awareness of false confessions is definitely increasing. And I think that there are, you know, movements to get the techniques to be more in line with best practices. But I don't see a real movement to move away from using false evidence.
All right. We're talking to Jennifer Lackey. Our guest is here, and we're talking about a number of issues. You've been hearing a lot of conversations about the issue of false confessions. Jennifer is the Wayne and Elizabeth Jones Professor of Philosophy at Northwestern University and the director and founder of the Northwestern Prison Education Program. She's in Rochester as a guest of the Humanities Center at the University of Rochester, delivering a lecture at 5 p.m. tonight. The lecture titled Extracted Evidence, False Confessions, and Testimonial Injustice. It is part of the Humanity Center's public lecture series. So that's 5 p.m. today. And let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back from break, we're going to explore some of your feedback to this. We've got some emails to read. We're also going to talk about her experience teaching in prison settings as well. There's a lot Jennifer's learned there. So let's get that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Irish Children's Program of Rochester began in 1982, inviting an equal number of Catholic and Protestant children to Rochester for weeks at a time to live with host families, to make friendships, and to bring down barriers. And now, at a time of polarization in American society, we talk to people from the Irish Children's Program about how they have taken down barriers, what we all learn from that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got a lot of listener feedback already to sort through on the subject of false confessions. There's some really compelling stuff this hour. Before we do that, our news director, Randy Gorman, is popping back in for a brief moment. Hello, Randy.
Yeah, just reminding you, Evan, it won't take much time here because you do have people already waiting to call into the program, I'm sure, as well as social media. But again, that's what Connections is all about, is engaging the community on issues that are important to a lot of people. And a lot of people listen to public broadcasting and, of course, WXXI here in Rochester for that. But we need your support to continue this kind of programming. Whatever you can do right now in terms of donating will help us throughout the year. The number is 585-454-6300, 585-454-6300, toll-free 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can just do it online at wxxinews.org or weos.org, and you can also donate very easily from the all-new WXXI app. Evan?
All right, Randy, thank you very much. Some email to work through. First of all, Mark writes to us and says, I'm sorry, but you could not ever get me to confess to something that I did not do. I do not care how long I have been in that room. I do not care what evidence or so-called evidence they are presenting me. I just don't believe it could happen, not at the level of 100% like your guest said. That's Mark. Okay, so Mark is disputing that you could ever get him to confess. What would you say to Mark?
Well, I think that Mark is probably far more likely to falsely confess than he thinks. I mean, so again, I discussed some of the tactics that are used. There are also what are called minimization tactics. And so the interrogators will use things to minimize both the moral significance of what you did, the legal repercussions, the practical consequences. So they'll say things to you like, look, if you just come clean, they're going to go a lot easier on you than if we take this to trial. Right. If you just kind of tell us what you did, then, you know, things are going to be a lot better for you. They will say things like, look, I understand where you come from. I would have done the same thing. You know, did you just lose it at some point? Is that why you did this? So there's all sorts of ways in which they try to motivate you to think it's in your best interest to say this. So I think that that's exactly what I think drives jurors, drives, interrogators, drives the overall criminal justice system to take confession evidence so, you know, to weigh it so heavily. But I think that what the empirical evidence is showing on the psychological and in the social sciences is that actually it's not difficult at all to get a false confession out of us.
So when Mark says you couldn't get me to do it and you say Mark is more likely than he thinks to confess, the point is we all are more likely to confess.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Angela wants to know if there's a racial component to false confessions.
There is. There are definitely, you know, when you look at the exonerations, you know, many of the exonerations are of people of color. And so certainly when we think about the lens through which we're giving this evidence far more credibility than it deserves, just this confession evidence, but not the recantation evidence by the very same person, certainly the biases and prejudices that the interrogators bring to the table are impacting that. But one thing that is really interesting about confession evidence is that while there is this racial dimension to it, confession evidence just in general seems to have this swamping effect, no matter what the person's kind of the prior biases and prejudices that the interrogators have are.
Okay. Robert writes to us and says, I know the Netflix series Making a Murderer is controversial, but the actual footage of where the police are interrogating Stephen Avery, and you can hear them trying to get him to misspeak, accidentally make a false statement, is disturbing because it isn't an accident. Police need to make a conviction. And he says, I'm just going to say it. When they nab a suspect who fits the description in even the slightest way, they seem to push for a confession. Mm. Is that an overbroad statement about police conduct?
Well, again, I'm reluctant to make generalizations.
That's why I ask, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of different things motivating people in different cases, some of which are probably utterly benign motivations, thinking that, you know, the aim is really to get someone who is potentially dangerous off the streets. This is why I think it's really important that we, you know, raise awareness about the likelihood and the prevalence of false confessions. Because I think that in many cases, the weight that confession evidence is given is actually quite innocent.
All right. Bob writes to us from Parenton. He says, Evan, thanks for touching on this topic. Here's my take. Police are highly trained in interview and interrogation tactics and psychology, while the general population is not trained in counterinterrogation tactics or their rights, including how and when to demand legal representation. I feel like today's police training and culture leads them to believe that all perps are guilty until proven otherwise, and there are, quote, good guys and bad guys. This oversimplified approach fosters rifts in police and community relationships and leads to unwarranted arrests, false confessions, and convictions. My brother is a hardworking police officer, and I respect the men and women that serve our community. It is a difficult job, and they often deal with abuses from criminals and highly dangerous situations. However, the job is protect and serve, not be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's from Bob. What would you say about that?
Yes, I mean, I very much agree. And I think that while police officers are trained in extracting confessions, what we need to make sure is that they are trained in extracting reliable confessions, true confessions. And I think that what has happened is the training has provided tactics for actually getting people to admit to something that they didn't always do. And that's what we need to be aware of.
Joan, you want to add to that?
Well, actually, I was interested in the comment from the previous listener. In fact, just go back to that for a minute, because I've been listening to Jennifer Lackey and thinking about the role of the media. And, I grew up on Perry Mason, where there's a courtroom confession. I did it. And yes, I couldn't stand him anymore, and I choked him to death. Is there an impact either on the view that we have of the criminal justice system or where we might wind up if we confess, that comes from the amount of media that we watch.
Talked Perry Mason.
Grissom
did everything. He collected the evidence. He interrogated the suspects. He got the confession. Sometimes he tackled them in the back alley. Is this notion of the drama that we see, I think what Joan is saying, in media, does that filter into sort of our expectations in very real ways that can have pernicious effects?
Yeah, and I think both, if I could just add, both in terms of how we weigh the confession, because that's always a moment of closure, right? And also whether or not we will make a confession and think, okay, now we'll be turned over to a more benign system, as you said earlier.
Mm. Okay.
Yes, I mean, I definitely think that the media contributes to this, which is why documentaries like Making a Murderer that takes us step by step through a confession like Brendan Dassey's as a juvenile sitting there without a parent or counsel and seeing how he is led to confess to something that many people believe he didn't do. I think that's why the media getting involved in producing these documentaries like Making a Murderer, like False Confession Tapes, is really important to counter some of this sort of fiction that, when someone confesses something, that's the end. That's the end of seeking justice.
Christina emails the program to say, I understand the idea that we are more likely to confess than we think, but how much do things like upbringing and childhood experiences influence our likelihood of doing so? Do place in society and financial status during childhood also somehow influence this beyond race?
So absolutely. I mean, I talked mostly about situational factors, but there's also dispositional factors that make people more likely to falsely confess. So one is juvenile status. So absolutely, juveniles are far more likely to confess than adults are. Also, various kinds of mental impairment. So when you look at some of the well-known cases of false confessions, they might be in the middle of a psychotic episode when they confess, or they might be in the after hours and hours of sleep deprivation, be far more cognitively vulnerable. So these sorts of dispositional factors also contribute to false confessions.
All right, this is Manon in Rochester on the phone. Next, go ahead, Manon.
Hi, Evan. I just wanted to comment that there is an excellent article in National Geographic of 2016 on the real CSI, and there are many cases there that the CSI never solved. An innocent man in Maryland was put to jail for 19 years for a crime he never committed, and he was black. And there was another man in Utica prison. He was his name was Barnes. He was accused of rape, and he didn't commit the rape. He didn't even confess to it. A lot of innocent people go to jail for no reason. And that article on the real CSI on National Geographic is excellent, and everyone should look at it. The other thing I want to say, Evan, is in Maryland, there was a good police officer. The other police officers killed him because he was going to expose their drug dealing to the police officers. In Greece, there was the Greek chief of police and his son did the crime. They did drugs, and the community protested. Now, what we need in our country is to train these police officers to be compassionate and caring and care about the human beings and people and stop implicating them in false crimes like Mark Furman. Thank you, Evan.
All right, Manon, thank you. So there's a passionate response to this. We're getting a lot of feedback from a lot of different quarters. Before we move to sort of a related but different subject with Jennifer Lackey, our guest, so go ahead and kind of set your menu. If you had the chance to really change the system, what is your priority list for what changes when it comes to interrogation, how it happens to really limit or eliminate the possibility of a false confession?
So I think that we should not allow the presentation of false evidence. I think that's one thing. So it's, for instance, illegal to make a promise in the interrogation room that you can't keep. But there are all sorts of promises that are pragmatically implicated just through implicature. Things will be a lot better for you. I can assure you that if you do this, you know, it's not an outright promise, but, you know, lots of people in those kinds of situations interpret them as promises. So I think removing the presentation of false evidence, not allowing even kind of these pragmatic implicatures of promises that are false, would go a ways towards that. But I also think that just this broader, taking a step back and realizing that confession evidence is one piece of evidence. Just like when we find, you know, kind of, you know, a piece of clothing, or we find, you know, there's an eyewitness report, or all of these are pieces of evidence. And we need to look at the totality of the body of evidence in order to, you know, kind of ascertain, you know, guilt or innocence in the criminal justice system.
And just given the idea of presenting false evidence, that's something that a lot of our listeners have never thought about because they've probably never been interrogated. Mm-hmm. But what's the final point you'd put on that for people who are doubting that it's that effective or that important involved in these false confessions?
Well, just like your listeners, you know, kind of are doubting that, you know, they would succumb to falsely confessing, I think many of us also, you know, especially if we've never been interrogated before and we don't know much about the criminal justice system, we go into that room and we have absolutely no idea that it is legal, that people would actually lie to us in that room. So we're in a situation in which we are taking, you know, kind of the state to be an authority, right? And to be honest with us and to be trustworthy. And so when they tell us, I have your fingerprints, I have your DNA evidence, we take that to be credible. We take that to be reliable. And so we start backing up and we try to tell a narrative that accommodates that evidence. So I think that, you know, for people who really doubt this, I think it's really important to realize that part of that doubt comes from the belief that you're operating within a situation of trustworthiness.
And just going back to the Innocence Project numbers, roughly 100 people over the last 30 years have been exonerated for crimes they did not commit despite having confessed to that crime falsely. What is a realistic goal in our society in terms of false confessions? Can we have a society where we don't have false confessions anymore?
Well, I mean, I don't think that because you can never account for the people who might even falsely confess just for reasons that don't have to do with the interrogation techniques or, you know, so I don't think that, I mean, I think we need to just always, factor in just human variability.
Sure.
But I think in terms of our practices, both in terms of how we're extracting the confessions and in terms of how we're weighing them, those are two different aspects that we need to focus on, both how we're getting them and then what we're doing with that evidence. I think that we can, especially especially with all of the research that has been done in recent years on how easy it is to get them and how prevalent they are, I think we can actually start to revise the criminal justice system in ways that will lead to fewer convictions on the basis of false confessions.
And again, for a police officer or an interrogator to say, look, you have no idea how hard it is to get someone to confess. You know, we need to value that. It sounds to me like what you're saying is not that throw out confessions, no. but weigh them more appropriately.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm not telling people don't try to get a confession. I'm trying to say don't have the investigation end there. Continue to look for other evidence. And when you find other evidence, go back and be willing to reassess the confession evidence.
All right. Let me get a couple more of your phone calls on this subject. You've lit a fire in our listeners with this subject. It's just a lot of passionate response to this. And let's go ahead and let's take John in Rochester first. I think that's you. Is that you, John?
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, for your guest. When you bring up this subject, I think of Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos in the so-called Russian collusion thing. Flynn went into the he was assured by the FBI that he doesn't need his attorney, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out they used what he said against them. How would you categorize that?
I think that we all should, we obviously have the right to have counsel present. We should exercise that right. But as adults, if you waive that right, I think that, I'm a particularly strong proponent of not allowing any sort of interrogation of juveniles without some support present. I'm not really sure that I know how to assess a case where an adult, particularly an adult who knows the repercussions, waives their right to counsel and then has that evidence used against them.
Well, I think it shows your point that this could happen to anybody. Here's Gerald Flynn was a pretty sophisticated guy, and he put a lot of trust into the FBI that they would be fair. And in his opinion, they weren't fair.
Yeah, and I don't know all the details of the case. I mean, was he offered promises? Was he, did they present any false evidence? I don't know all of the evidence involved in the case. But I certainly would say that I would stand by any one of us could probably be a candidate for a false confession. So, I mean, it's not surprising.
Dan emailed us to say an earlier email said that a, quote, good cop can get a false confession and even make an innocent person believe they're guilty. It's worth pointing out the adjective he uses for an effective manipulator who subverts justice in order to frame an innocent person is good. It would seem that this is part of police culture, to pressure and bully people, including children, into confessing to crimes. Can your guests speak about why this would be? Why would police torture a confession out of someone that, based on the evidence, they may not even believe is guilty? What do the police get out of this? Is this just a game that they are trying to win? I'll let you answer that. Again, Dan is making generalizations here. And I think Jennifer Lackey, our guest, has been really careful not to overgeneralize. And in fact, in many ways, to praise the work and the work of so many police officers across the country. I mean, I hope that is echoed and clear here. But I think to Dan's point, he's concerned that once you get to this point, the motives seem to be not necessarily always just about justice, but about winning. I got this confession. I did a good job. Is there something to that?
I think there are cases of that. Again, I think that, as you said, I wouldn't generalize. I think there are certainly cases where people are reluctant to admit mistakes. I think that there are cases where people are really just looking for another conviction or another closed investigation. But I do think that what I find particularly interesting about false confessions are the cases where it's not motivated by, kind of these malicious or unjust intentions, but where it really is rooted in this belief that no one would say this unless they really did it. Those are the cases where I think we can actually make real progress by raising awareness that actually this happens, it can happen, and it most likely would happen to you.
Jackie from Geneva says, I would have been firmly in the same camp as a previous emailer saying that you could never get me to confess to something I did not do. until I started looking around at the prevalence of gaslighting, both in interpersonal relationships, domestic violence situations, but also on the national political scene. It no longer seems like a crazy idea that you could get somebody to believe something that their own experience tells them is not the truth, and not just believe it, but to own it and become the champion of it. False confessions seem like a species of the same kind of psychological manipulation. Psychological manipulation? It can be?
It can be, certainly. And I think that the connection with gaslighting is a really interesting one, because I do think that you can look upon what's happening in the interrogation room as a condensed version of a longer-term gaslighting situation, particularly when you're doing things like presenting false evidence and trying to get the victim to explain this away. When you actually watch false confession tapes, you will see there will be this moment where they say things like, I guess I must have been there. Maybe I forgot. I mean, there is this moment where they think there is no other plausible explanation of this other than that I was there.
Like they've got my boot print in the ground there.
That's right.
They've got my fingerprint.
Yeah.
I guess there's something I don't know about
that's
myself.
That's right. I guess I was there.
Huh. And Lucille in Rochester on the phone on the same subject. Go ahead, Lucille.
Yes. I believe that, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a law change in New York State that a 17-year-old, one being interrogated, has to have a parent present. And in cases where, before the law was enacted, is there any possibility that they would go back and look 3 years back at what happened without the parent there and maybe invalidating the confession or adjusting it in some way?
I mean, certainly that evidence can be raised, and it is raised. I mean, there are plenty of cases, including the high-profile Brendan Dassey case, where looking at the unreliability of confession evidence, particularly in isolated juveniles, is presented. It's not always effective. It's not always effective in, you know, overturning convictions, but it certainly is the sort of evidence that can be presented with the hope that the system will appreciate its significance.
All right. So tonight, you're presenting 5 p.m. So if you want to join Jennifer Lackey for the presentation, she's in Rochester. She is a guest at the Humanities Center at the University of Rochester for an event tonight. The presentation is called Extracted Evidence, False Confessions, and Testimonial Injustice. It's at 5 p.m. tonight at Rush Reese Library. Jennifer is the director and founder of the Northwestern Prison Education Program. And I want to turn to an essay you wrote for the New York Times in February of 2016 called The Irrationality of Natural Life Sentences. This wasn't per se about false confessions. It was about your experience simply teaching in a prison setting and the growth that you had seen and some of the ways that we might have stereotypes about people. Frankly, you're teaching people in that setting who have committed murders and people who have committed murders, people who have committed violent crimes. The stereotypes we may have about them, but the reality that you experience. Take me through some of that.
So in our discussions, I think our public discussions about the criminal justice system, the focus tends to be on, you know, what are called nonviolent offenders or nonviolent offenses when people are asking for changes in the criminal justice system. Most of my work, in fact, all of my work has been in maximum security facilities. So I'm dealing with, you know, nearly all of my students have been convicted of at least one murder. And I think that one of the things that is really important to recognize is that many of these crimes, in fact, nearly all of them among the people that I've interacted with, were committed when they were very young people, mm-hmm. 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. A lot of these men are now in their 30s, are now in their 40s. They're unrecognizable from their 15-year-old selves, from their 16-year-old selves. And so when we, you know, kind of impose a sentence of natural life where we say no matter who you become, no matter what you do, we as a state will never even take a second look at you. It's, you know, we will never even kind of revisit what you have accomplished. At 15 years old, you did something such that we will never actually even open the door again. Really ignores decades of the possibility of powerful transformation that I see, particularly, you know, when we're moving from someone being a juvenile, a child, into adulthood. All of us dramatically change between the ages of 14 and 25. And I mean, you know, the neuroscience says as much, right? And so to have people, you know, never actually be able to revisit who they are, what they've accomplished, who they've become, I think is actually an irrational, not just an immoral. Notice that my piece is not, I mean, I think that it might be immoral as well. But the real argument is that I actually think it's ignoring powerful evidence.
I don't want to pose like a Michael Dukakis question, which I actually think, and I'll show a little bias here, I thought the premise of the question during the 1988 debate was not all that productive. I thought it was everyone feels emotion about the notion of losing someone. So I don't want to do the, well, look, if it was one of your family members who was murdered by someone that you were teaching. But I do think it's at least... I do want to probe that a little bit because I know some of our listeners will feel that way, which is that, you know, Jennifer Lackey, it's easy for you to say this. You haven't had someone, you know, whose life was taken from them who was close to you. And they also, there's an idea, and I don't know if you can speak to the psychology of it, but some people assume even if you did something when you're 18 years old and now you're 48 and you have studied, you've taken classes, you can speak about Monet and literature in ways that most people can't. You want to work, you would be productive upon release. But some people believe that psychologically, if you are capable of committing a violent crime, a crime like murder, that there's no predicting that you couldn't be capable again. And I don't know if there's evidence of that, but I know some people believe that. So
there's actually explicit evidence against that.
Okay.
So there is, you know, so... people will say there are only two reliable predictors of recidivism rates, one of them being age. People just age out of, this is just an empirical fact, people age out of violence. So there is actually very powerful, you know, data that shows that people over the age of 50 are extraordinarily unlikely, no matter what, to commit any violent crimes. So, I mean, there really is a question about what the function is of incarcerating people beyond certain ages, even independently of asking this question about the transformation. It's just that even just biologically, people just change over the course of years. They age out of it, even if they were actually prone to violence as very young people. So that is, I think, one thing to note. Another thing that I think is really important to note is that there are many other countries that just don't have anything that resembles a natural life sentence. So let's look at Norway, for instance, where the maximum sentence is 21 years. Even if you murder over 70 people, it's 21 years is the maximum sentence. And it can be, you know, they'll revisit it after 21 years and they can add 5-year increments after that. But there is no natural life sentence where at one moment in time we say, that's it, we're never ever going to even revisit who you are or what you have done. And in those countries, when you actually talk to the people who have been, who have had, you know, family members who have been victimized, they have a powerful sense that justice has been served by getting a 21-year sentence. And that's because they're shaped by the conception that the maximum sentence is 21 years. That's punishment enough. I think we have been conditioned in this society to think that either death or natural life, because it's the maximum, my family member deserves the maximum, whatever that is.
Okay, well, for I think the case that you're referencing, someone who commits a murder of 70 people, was, we're referencing the actual real life case mm-hmm. there, right? The mass shooter. So again, just viscerally, some people see that and say, yeah, that person should never ever see daylight. That person should never be given a chance to reform. Mm-hmm. You're making a very strong case that even in the extreme cases, you believe reform is possible.
I think that even in the extreme cases, what I'm recommending is that we revisit the person. We revisit the case, we revisit the sentence. And I think that just from a purely rational point of view,
sure,
it's relevant evidence.
Okay, and I'm going to squeeze kind of a heavy thing into the last 2 minutes, probably at my own peril here. But when we've talked about, for example, the effort to try to prevent mass violence, prevent school shootings, there's a lot of discussion about, well, could you find a way to sort of predict it or get in the way of disrupting it? And there was a lot of talk about psychopathy, nonviolent psychopathy, because not even everyone with psychopathy is a violent person. There's plenty of people with psychopathy who are CEOs. It's actually quite a good thing in business, probably. But should there, once there is violence, should we at least be brain scanning? Should we try to determine if this person cannot feel any empathy, is not capable of it, maybe we shouldn't be condoning release?
Well, I mean, at a minimum, what I would suggest is that our mental health treatment in prisons right now needs to be radically improved. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the data about the number of people who are incarcerated who have mental health issues, it's staggering. And when you look at that and you compare it with how many are actually getting the treatment that they need, it's appalling. And so as a first step, what I would recommend is that we radically increase our treatment of mental health issues of, you know, people who are incarcerated.
All right, Joan, 30 seconds. What are you looking forward to most with this evening's presentation?
It's going to be great. We've heard Jennifer's passion and her articulate presentation of these very important questions. And this adds to our whole theme for the year, expertise and evidence, as we contemplate together these big questions of what constitutes evidence and what is the nature of belief. And we are all about the human experience. This is a great take on a portion of the human experience, and I welcome everyone to join us tonight.
Joan's the director of the Humanities Center at the University of Rochester, and their series rolls on tonight. It's 5 o'clock at Rush Reese Library. There's free parking there. You can find it. Shouldn't be hard to find. And that's for Jennifer Lackey and her presentation tonight, Extracted Evidence, False Confessions, and Testimonial Injustice. Jennifer is a professor of philosophy at Northwestern University and the director and founder of Northwestern's Prison Education Program. Thank you for your insight this hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. Short
Thank
break.
You.
More connections coming up.